Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Florida is home to a wide array of flora and fauna, but not all of it is native. Actually, quite a lot of what you see in the world around you is considered to be invasive. For the rest of the hour today, we're going to get a lesson on Florida's many invasives with Charles Sobczak. The Sanibel-based author will be presenting two lectures on Florida's invasives later this month. The first one is at the downtown Fort Myers Library on June 18th at 6:30 in the evening. There's another one later that week at Gulfgate Library in Sarasota. His lectures are based on information he gathered for his book, The Living Gulf Coast, A Nature Guide to Southwest Florida. Charles Sobczak, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. It's a pleasure.
Hey, it's nice to be here, Mike. Thank you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you're always invited to participate in the show by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. So what is your favorite invasive species story to tell?
Oh, my favorite. None of them are really much of my favorite. I think the worst one we have going for us right now, arguably, is the lionfish.
Right. So what have you learned about the lionfish? That's a fairly new phenomenon, so it's kind
That's only a couple years old. The guess is that they were pet releases on the East Coast. No one's 100% sure. And they've really decimated – wherever they've increased exponentially, they've really decimated native fish populations. They're out here. I'm hoping that the Goliath grouper are eating them, but there's no confirmation of
that.
They're
very poisonous to humans, right?
The food is not just
right.
The spines.
Well, no, exactly. No. Well, and that was my question is, I mean, if a Goliath grouper eats one, can it poison it or how does that work?
Yeah, the spines, the tips of the spines are venomous. I don't know. In Southeast Asia where they're from off of Australia, New Guinea, that kind of area, there are groupers that eat them. So whether or not our groupers, especially the big ones, are capable of eating them is yet to be determined. But I hope it does because otherwise they're somewhat unstoppable.
Right. Well, you know, that you mentioned in an email to me about the cover of Smithsonian Magazine with the lionfish. And I was reading through that and it said that the females can lay 4,000 eggs every few days or something like that.
30 million a year.
Wow. That seems like, pretty – unstoppable if we're not even sure anything can eat them other than us.
Yeah, that is pretty unstoppable, and that's kind of the problem. Now, over time, it kind of does balance out, but time could be 30, 40, 50 years.
Right.
So that's like my least favorite. There's an interesting point that I bring out in the lecture that some of these invasives have saved our animals, which gets really, really where it gets really nuanced and complicated. Two examples of this. The brown anole, the Cuban anole, which is the anole we see everywhere.
Right, which I saw rarely when I was a kid.
That's
correct.
There
used to be the skinny green guys, and now there's the big brown guys.
The skinny green guys are, for the most part, gone. If you want to see them, go to Corkscrew. But the little brown guys are everywhere. But the little brown guys now have moved into a major feed for all of our cattle egret, all of our herons, the egrets, the great white egrets that you see along the road, they're all picking off and eating those little anoles. Mm. So they've become a real stable food source. Mm. A more interesting one was in the 20s when the Florida deer, were responsible for a disease that was killing cattle, and the cattle ranchers killed all the deer. There was nothing for the Florida panther to survive on except wild pigs, feral pigs, which were left here by either DeSoto or Ponce de Leon in about 1520.
Hmm. You know, it seems like the history of the invasives is sometimes, influences. You do one thing and you cause another. I mean, can you think of a good example of that? Is the Melaleuca fall into that category, do you know?
Yes, the Melaleuca was brought in to drain the swamps and it did such a fine job that they had to try and drain the Melaleuca.
Right.
The cane toads are a perfect example.
Oh, okay. So they were brought here for a reason?
To eat the – there was some kind of a cane beetle. So they brought in the cane toads to eat the cane beetle, and the cane toads decided, hey, we like Florida. We're going to leave the cane fields, and they didn't do very well eating the beetles. And now we have them on Sanibel.
Right. And these are the ones that if a pet – gets a hold of them, they can kill the pet.
They will kill the pet. They will kill the dog or the cat if they get into those. Those are poisonous. Those are not venomous. Those are poisonous. If they eat that toad or even put it in their mouth, They get sick and die sometimes within minutes.
And these are the ones that get real big, like crazy big. In Australia,
they go to 6 pounds.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, they can eat just about small dogs. That's how big they are.
And I guess they can swim? I mean, if they're on Sanibel, how does that work?
Well, you know, what happens
they
is
hop across the causeway?
That's a good question. How do they get there? They get there probably by adhering the eggs onto the feet of ducks.
Oh.
And then they stick to the duck feet or the wading bird feet, and then they fly to the next place, and then they deposit.
That makes
the
a
eggs.
Lot more sense than hopping across the causeway.
They did not hop across the causeway.
Did I read in one of the things that you sent that one of the egrets is not native? Or
yes, actually, there's two of them.
Because that surprised me a lot.
There's two of them, and that's kind of a fascinating story too. The one that we see everywhere, which is now the most populous egret in all of North America, is the cattle egret.
And that's the one you said was eating the anole.
The invasive. But the cattle egret got here on its own. It came here, they think, in the eye wall of a hurricane and landed in Venezuela in the 30s and has been spreading. It's all through South America, all the way now up into Canada. And they're the ones that block traffic on Periwinkle during season, if in case you're wondering. They stand out there and they don't care.
Yeah, they don't give a – yeah.
No.
Brazilian pepper, that's one that, you know, I think that – you know, I remember when I was a kid, it was literally everywhere. It was in people's yards. I mean, no. But now I think people have sort of gained an understanding that it's not, you know, not to be fooled with. Do you know what its history is, how it wound up here?
There's conflicting. There's no real record of exactly when it got here. One story I heard was in the 20s, a doctor out of Punta Gorda brought it up from Brazil as a decorative spray during Christmas. They call it Christmas holly because of the beautiful red berries.
Right.
And he brought it up. But there again, that's a major food source for a lot of birds now. Those little berries, that's free food, of course, and they're the ones who propagate it. On Sanibel, my conservative estimate, we've spent over $1 million trying to eradicate Brazilian pepper. And unfortunately, the birds fly in from Pine Island or from South Fort Myers, and they bring it back again. So it's the Sisyphean myth. You can push the rock up the hill, and it just comes down on you again.
Is there a point, do you know, at which and maybe this is more of a question for a biologist, but at which a species becomes – you know, it's been here for so long, even though it was non-native or invasive, that it becomes actually considered local, naturalized?
Yeah, I think we could make that application to us.
Okay. good answer. Well, can you flesh out the difference between non-native and invasive?
No. And that's really interesting because last week we had the privilege and joy of taking a hike through Audubon Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. And while we were there at the overlook, about halfway through the trail, there's a beautiful overlook. And I'm looking down and I'm seeing a half a dozen workers down there in bright orange with chainsaws. And I looked down and one of the guys walked by me and I said, "Hey, what are you guys, what invasives are you cutting down?" He said, "We're not cutting down invasives. We're cutting down coastal plain willow." I said, "Why are you cutting down? It's a native tree." He said, "Yeah, but it's been known and it will overwhelm systems."
Gotcha.
So even the term invasive is complicated. The coyotes, another prime example. Mm-hmm. There were never coyotes here. They're here now, but they were here in North America. Do we consider them invasive or just expanding their range due to changed circumstances?
Right. Yeah, I've been camping since I was a kid out on Fish Eating Creek, and it wasn't until just a couple years ago that we started hearing the coyotes at night, which is really an interesting experience to hear that here in South Florida, you know?
I love Fish Eating Creek. Good choice. And yeah, they're on Sanibel. A recent study, and I don't know that this is true, guesstimated that there were as many as 60 coyotes on Sanibel.
Hmm.
I don't think that's accurate. I think the number's closer to 30 or 40. But when the sirens go off, we hear the coyotes.
You mean when the sirens, like the police or fire, they respond?
Yeah, they always do.
Wow,
it's
that's
funny.
Like a premise of a book.
they start yipping. It's really fun.
Hmm. We're talking about invasive plants and animals on today's show with author Charles Sobczak. If you'd like to join our conversation, you're always invited to call. Just call 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So your upcoming presentation is based on your book, The Living Gulf, A Nature Guide to Southwest Florida. How did you do the research for that book? What was your sort of method and sources? And did you talk to people? Did you do a lot of reading?
I did a whole lot of all those things?
All
of the above. But in terms of the destinations section of the book, which it has 60 destinations really well defined, I talked to the local visitors and tourists. And I said, I'm writing a book of great places to visit. What would you recommend in your county as the best eco tourist kind
right,
of destinations?
Right, the corkscrews and the six-mile cypresses.
I'm so happy to say that Lee County Visitors and Convention Bureau, Sarasota, Collier, not only did they help me with the answers to that, but they supplied me with great photographs of Lover's Key, stuff that I had no access to. They were just thrilled about the book.
Hmm.
So there was a lot of help from a lot of people.
Have you given many presentations like these ones that you're giving later this month, or sort of how did that come about?
I've been doing lectures for Road Scholar for 15 years now. I do about 15 a year for them alone, and I've done lectures for the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, for the Harvard Club. I've got ones coming up for the University Women's Club. I do a lot of lectures, but I want to add something here, and it's going to be difficult to do without being silly. I have kind of invented a thing which I call eco-humor.
Okay.
Because some of the stuff we do is so silly and out of the box. I end this lecture and I'm going to wreck the ending. So if you're coming, as a spoiler alert. So, recently Tesla shot that
His Model S into space with the Rocket Man in it.
Okay. So I know kind of after studying invasive species, I'm fairly sure that there's a couple of cockroaches somewhere in there and probably a Burmese python in the trunk. And we'll go to Mars and we'll find that they got there ahead of us. But, it's fun to laugh at us too.
Yeah.
We're a funny species.
Absolutely. So what are some of the other species that are invasives that you've discovered through your research over the years that people might not realize are invasives?
The most dangerous animal in the world, Aedes aegypti.
Oh, the mosquito.
That is an invasive species that's just absolutely horrific. And throughout the world, it kills more people than anybody through malaria.
So where is it endemic? Where is it from?
It's originally from sub-Saharan Africa, but it's now what they call, and I didn't even know of this term, it's called a domesticated invasive species. It's actually learned to live and wrap its entire life around us. So wherever we go, Aedes aegypti follows, and they got here via airplanes.
Huh. So that would be fairly recently then because
I would say in the 50s.
Oh, really?
In the 60s, yeah. And now they're here. They're here in this county, and they're here throughout South Florida, and they continue to expand because of climate change. They're moving north.
We had other kinds of mosquitoes then?
Oh, yeah. Of course, we had salt marsh mosquitoes.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
All the, there's lots of endemic species.
Gotcha. That makes sense. We had a caller ask or say that she heard that the flamingo was reclassified as native to Florida. Do you know what the background on the flamingo?
Yes, it is, and she is correct. When Sanibel was first more or less homesteaded out in the 1870s, 1880s, we had flamingos on Sanibel. And there are still indigenous flamingos down in Everglades City and in Flamingo, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people thought it came here on its own, but in fact, it's always been here. It's actually been knocked back. It hasn't interfaced well with us. But it is a native species.
Huh. What do you know about palm trees? I don't know if they're considered invasive because I don't know how quickly they spread, but as I understand it, a lot of the palm trees that we have, like in the City of Palms in Fort Myers, are not palms that you would have found here before we got here.
But most of those are not invasive. In other words, they have really difficult times.
Yeah, that's
spreading.
What I was kind of thinking is they stay where we put them.
The ones that have really won in that way are Brazilian pepper, Australian pine, Melaleuca, and there's a ton – air potato. There's a ton of others that are doing extremely well.
How is Sanibel doing in the post-Irma environment?
It's pretty well cleaned up. Driving into the school, into the university here, I could see you've got a lot of Melaleuca that have blown down.
Oh, yeah.
You've got more down than we do now. But you were on the more dangerous side of the storm. You were on the side that was windier.
What made me think that was when you said the Australian pines because, Sanibel back because of Charlie – you know, driving down Periwinkle used to be an entirely different experience, and it was because mostly of those Australian pines that created the big
cathedral.
So that's kind of do you guys miss them out there? Are you happy you were able to get rid of them?
No, I don't miss them. I don't miss them at all. It's great burning firewood, and it's not a pine. It's actually it's more closely related to an oak. People don't know that, but it's a nasty invasive, and Charlie took out the vast majority.
Yeah.
I bet you I'll guess 40,000 Australian pines blew down between Captiva and Sanibel.
And that's because they're not meant to be here, so they're not really able to withstand the high winds because they have the shallow roots, right?
They all blew down, exactly. They all toppled, leaving these giant root balls.
I still remember that first time I went back out to Sanibel after Charlie, and I just couldn't believe it. You know, as somebody who grew up here and had been down that drive so many times, it's like being – it was like being in a different island.
Yeah.
I guess that's 15 years ago now or almost, something like that.
It's canopied pretty well now. It's looking good again, but yes, we lost a lot of them. Another really bad one that I should add are the lizards. We've got the tegu lizard coming now from the East Coast. We've got up on North Captiva, not in both North Captiva and beyond in Boca Grande, they've got the black spiny-tailed. The iguanas. And we've got the green iguanas, which is funny, which is a good story. A lot of people in the cold snap, the green iguanas would get really cold, and then they become completely immobile, and they fall down, and people would think they were dead, and they'd like put them in their trunk or in their back seat to bring them to the, you know, to get rid of them. And then they'd wake up in the heat of the car, and you'd have a 5-foot iguana, you know, as you're driving down Periwinkle. I'm sure that would be fun.
How often do you see iguanas or the tegus out on Sanibel?
No tegus yet. The
no
green iguanas,
yet.
We see them. I see them every other week. They're everywhere and all released pets, and they've propagated now. They're pretty well established.
How long have you lived on Sanibel?
Over 30 years.
Okay. How much, besides the trees that we just discussed, how much have things changed in terms of the environment out there that you can remember and feel from your 30 years there?
Well, you know, not as much as you might think, because the rules kept, you know, Sanibel pretty much Sanibel as compared to other places.
Yeah.
And they've still stopped, you know, the density levels are still pretty low. And the city has done a wonderful job of buying a lot of properties like Sanibel Gardens Estates, et cetera. So there's a lot of good habitat out there. And it's Ding Darling is just a fantastic place to still see a lot of wildlife.
How much time do you spend out at Ding Darling?
I usually go to Ding Darling at least once a week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we bike through it.
Oh, well,
it's,
I guess
it's really nice.
That makes sense. So you've written a number of books over the years. Are you working on anything now?
I'm kind of kicking around a novel, but for the moment I'm taking a break. And Living Gulf Coast and Living Sanibel are both out of print officially now. So I don't think we're going to be reprinting them. There's a handful of copies left.
Gotcha. Okay, so now remind us, when are these lectures? There's one at the Downtown Library on the 18th, right?
I believe that, yes. It's 6:30, I believe. You've got it there. And then the other one is at 1 o'clock at Golden Gate up in Sarasota, and that's the following Friday.
Okay.
I believe it is.
All right. Well, any final thoughts?
Nope. Just if you've got an exotic pet, please don't release it. That's all I can tell you. They cause like billions of dollars of damage, and you never know which one's going to catch on.
Yeah.
So keep it at home or euthanize it at the end. Don't let it go. It's just not a good idea.
All right. That is all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank my guest. Charles Sobczak is an author and lecturer. He will be presenting two lectures on Florida's invasives later this month. The first one is at the Downtown Fort Myers Library on June 18th at 6:30 in the evening. The other one is at the Gulf Gate Library in Sarasota that following Friday at 1 in the afternoon. Charles, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Mike.
And thanks to my earlier guest, Rachel Curran from the Center for Biological Diversity, during our segment about Mosaic Fertilizer's proposed phosphate mine in DeSoto County near Arcadia. Our show today was produced by myself and Rachel Iacovone. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.